The first question I want to ask, and I'm going to direct this to you, Heidi, would you define gender, and particularly will you make a distinction between gender and sexuality? Because I think that's something that confuses a lot of people.
Sure. I understand, talk about, and think about gender in two parts. One being the way that we're sort of socialized to understand gender, and the other part being the way that we embody gender. And by socialization, of course, I mean what happens from the moment that your parents know that you're a girl or a boy, and sort of making decisions about the way they'll dress you, the toys that you will play with, and things like that. So they're in essence, and not just parents, of course, commercials and schools where they divide boy, girl, all those institutions then socialize us to perform gender in a certain way. As we get older, we start to make decisions about how we will embody gender. It's different from sex and sexuality in that way, sex organs being those biological organs that you're born with. And we know now more than we ever have, I think, that some people embody gender in a way that does not necessarily correlate with the traditional way in which their organ has decided their gender. So you have people who were born male doing femininity, people who were born women doing masculinity, and then sexuality, of course, being the way that you have sex. Which can be, you know, there are myriad ways to have sex and do sexuality despite or in spite of or because of the way you embody gender.
Julie, I wonder if I could ask you, you know, as someone who does family law and someone who handles cases with families that are either gay or lesbian or deal with transgender issues, is there a legal definition where gender is concerned that is either fixed or evolving? How do you understand it in as far as the law is concerned?
I'm not aware of any definition of gender within family law itself, but Colorado does have certain civil rights statutes that talk about gender, and they differentiate by referring to gender identity. As well as the assigned gender or the gender at which a child is assigned at birth, which mirrors what was just stated. So your gender identity then is the way in which the person perceives himself or herself, as opposed to their assignment at birth, which has to do with whether the birth certificate indicates male or female.
And this is a good place to turn to you, Stephanie, because you've been covering the Coy Mathis case, and I'm going to have you sort of outline that story a little bit. It's been a huge case. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and I'll let you talk a little bit about that. But I'm fascinated by this case in particular because in your article you mentioned that Coy began to express her gender at the age of 18 months, really. And I wonder if you could just go ahead and give us some background on that case.
Coy Mathis is a six-year-old transgender girl, and she was enrolled in Eagleside Elementary. And up through kindergarten, her peers accepted her as expressing herself as a little girl, even though she was born with male genitalia. And it really didn't present a problem because in kindergarten, they I think the boys and the girls both use the same restroom, and it's I guess gender neutral, and it didn't really present a problem at school for Coy until she entered first grade, where the restrooms were segregated, and she initially used the girls' restroom without there being much of a problem, and then the administration towards the end of that school year, her first grade year, would no longer allow her to use a little girl's restroom. And that's what sparked the filing of a discrimination lawsuit with the district. Her parents filed that.
And what was the outcome of the discrimination suit?
The Colorado Division of Civil Rights a couple weeks ago, actually July 17th, came out with their decision in favor of the Mathis family. So they decided that the school district had discriminated against Coy in that case.
What in your understanding, I'm gonna look to you, Heidi, again, is what is the issue that comes up for people around gender issues like this? Like, I'm wondering, how is it that a six-year-old girl with male genitalia can inspire fear and outrage and really just such confusion? How do you read that?
I think this is a very multi-layered issue, and a lot of it stems from the fact that people have a certain lack of knowledge about these issues. When you sort of gauge popular opinions about these issues, people express fears about molestation and rape, which assumes in a way that males are inherently conditioned to rape. You know, I don't want a male using the female restroom because I'm scared of what will happen to me, which assumes that men are going to go in the restroom and rape women, even if they themselves identify as women. Additionally, you know, people have fear about violence, and rape is, of course, violence. But there's a lot of public opinion about it, and people will say things like, you know, what if I'm attacked in the bathroom? If we let men in there, what's going to happen? And so I think, you know, I'm sort of eager for men to sort of step up and start to ask questions about why they are being perceived in such a way that, you know, a transgender girl using a woman's restroom invokes fear about violence and rape and all these things that there is no evidence to prove. So I think the reason why there's a lot of backlash about transgender individuals is because people are scared of things that don't exist because they don't know about, you know, these things in such a way. So that's just one aspect of it, I think, but it's one of the biggest that I would argue.
Julie, you obviously have dealt with cases where there are gender issues involved in custody of children, for example. Can you talk about some of what you've seen where people's fears or reactions get involved in these legal disputes?
Yes, I agree that a lot of people's reactions have to do with ignorance. And so if we don't understand something, if we don't know very much about something, we tend to be frightened about it. And the transgender topic has been hiding for a long time, and it has not taken the forefront. So at one point in time, people didn't think it was very common for maybe husbands to beat their wives, and that was just a very hush-hush subject. And then I remember even one of the Supreme Court justices mentioned that he had never met a gay person when two of his primary staff were gay men who had never come out to him. And then there's an issue here where, since people don't know what transgender is, I think they become freaked out that something bad will happen. It's just a general reaction. And then people also don't understand. They think, well, why would parents do this to a child to make her think that that she's the wrong gender, without recognizing that there are issues that science doesn't fully understand yet that cause little children to feel, some of them, to feel that somehow their body doesn't match their emotions as to who they think they are. That's the gender identity issue. So it really comes down to trying to help other people, whether it's a custody evaluator or a judge or even the soon-to-be ex-spouse, better understand what's going on so that they don't end up imagining this host of frightening possibilities that have nothing to do with reality. And I think that in the next 10 years or so, we're going to realize that there's a certain segment of the population that are transgendered, and it won't flip us out so much. We'll just accept it. It's some people have diabetes, and some people are transgendered, and some people have blonde hair, and it's just a reality of life. It's not something that people have to become frightened about, but it's such a stigma right now that there are issues that need to be addressed through education.
Stephanie, I wonder if you could talk about just what were some of the reactions from people that you spoke with to Coy Mathis? What were their fears, and what did you hear people articulating in terms of why they may not have wanted their children to share a bathroom with a transgender girl?
You know, I didn't hear any responses that spoke particularly to that. And from my reading of the determination by the Civil Rights Division, that neither the family nor the school received complaints from parents that really had to do with Coy using the little girl's bathroom. Actually, the biggest question, I guess the question I get most frequently from people who've called in to talk to me at the paper about it is just, how did the parents know that this is what she was expressing at when she was 18 months old, before she could really talk and say, I think I'm a girl. I think this is not who I feel like I am, not this body. So that's the biggest question people have posed to me, is that how could her parents possibly have known at 18 months?
One of the things that comes up for me when I think about these things is, well, okay, Coy Mathis is expressing that, you know, she wants to be a girl, but is it just male and female genders? And do we get kind of trapped into that, even where transgender issues are concerned? How do we think about it? What if it's something in between, or again, just where gender expression is concerned?
Well, Noel, that is a great, great point that I've been thinking about since we've been talking. If I could have a second to just give a quick narrative that helps me sort of situate my thoughts on this issue. My son and daughter are 19 months apart. When my son was 22 months old, I remember sitting there with his baby sister. She was 3 months old, and he was watching television, Nickelodeon, some, you know, child-friendly programming, and he started to say, "Chase," to his little baby sister who can't even talk. He says, "Chase, that's what you want. Mommy, that's what I want. Chase, that's what you want." And I'm like, "What?" And I asked him, "What are you talking about?" He was talking about the TV, commercials, toys, telling me and his baby sister what they wanted based on the way that the commercials gendered my kid. I didn't even get a chance to talk to him about masculinity and femininity. TV forced me to have that conversation with my not yet 2-year-old son before I was ready. And so when the parents are talking, or when other parents are concerned about how, you know, these parents knew that their child was going to express gender in a certain way at 18 months, would you ask the same question if your 18-month-old was going to express gender in the way that they were supposed to? No. The only time that becomes a question is when they're doing gender in a way that we have not yet sanctioned as okay. So when TV tells my son, boys play with Tonka trucks. Now, if the girls are going to play with Tonka trucks, they got to be pink. Or, you know, boys are going to play with science toys. Girls are going to play with dolls. Girls are going to play with kitchen toys. Girls are going to play with baby toys. You play with something else. It's no surprise to me why these parents, to me, it says that they were paying attention to their child and noticing that their child was interested in things that, you know, maybe they, based on society's determination, shouldn't have been. But why do we then, I ask, theoretically, ideologically, why do we keep assigning gender to things we do?
I want to move the conversation a little bit more towards what maybe would be more traditional gender issues, because one of the things that also happened was that the Pentagon announced that they would lift the 1994 combat exclusion rule and will begin to officially integrate women into the military, into active combat, I guess by 2016 is the official deadline. And again, here we're talking about a place where, traditionally speaking, gender is so differentiated, the military. You know, it's often thought of as a male domain, at least historically. Obviously, huge numbers of women have served in the military over the years. And yet now we're looking again at this sort of central issue of combat. And I guess I just want to ask you all personally how that, in your minds, changes essentially, you know, what the male female gender roles are in our society, and how you even react to that. I guess, Julie, I'll go back to you.
Oh, that's a big topic. Well, I think some of this comes down to the nature versus nurture dilemma that we've heard about for decades. In which the bottom line, I think, is that both contribute to one's identity. And so there are certain biological DNA, chemical, hormonal issues involved. During the feminist movement, a lot of us thought that if we just raise children in a gender-neutral way, that they will in fact turn out to be gender-neutral. And then, you know, a lot of these parents were shocked to find out that many of the girls really do prefer girly things, not that they would never cross over to some of the typically male things and vice versa, but that there's also environmental impacts. And I think when it comes to the decision for the combat in the military, I think that a lot of that comes down to economic equality and allowing women who have worked their whole lives to accomplish a certain goal do not have to reach the so-called glass ceiling and then not take the next step when they want to, that women are just as capable as men to do certain things, or at least the women who want to pursue that career. And and that finally the military is allowing those women to do so. And I think it just helps society recognize that while we still have ideas about girls and boys and male and female, that ultimately we are complete human beings who have a myriad of talents and that we should be allowed to pursue our talents.
Heidi.
One of the things that we know is that the ban was put in place banning women from combat because women were seen primarily as mothers. And so the government didn't want its women in combat because it risks their ability to produce the next generation of soldiers who should go to combat. And so now that the ban is lifted, one of the biggest things it does that I appreciate is it removes motherhood as the primary way in which women are identified and appreciated. I love being a mom with everything in me, but it is not and shouldn't be the only way in which my society values who I am. And so the ban for me was like a big moment for women in that we are seen as the multiplicitous beings we are and not just as moms, even though we don't mean to denigrate motherhood.
Stephanie, I want to ask you as a reporter, is there a learning curve for you in covering this issue? And do you think that that is also an issue for the media more broadly, is how to talk about these issues?
Well, I think there really is a pretty steep learning curve when it comes to this. Also, because I didn't want to go into it and write anything incorrect or offensive. Koi is a transgender girl, not a transgender boy. Right. I mean, it's things like that. And I had questions too when I first started writing about it. I wondered how a child at 18 months old was expressing her gender identity. So really it was just, for me, it was just finding out as much as I possibly could about Koi and about what she'd gone through. It's my understanding that when she was first expressing her gender identity as a girl, it was nonverbal. It was in the toys that she chose, the people. She wanted little girl friends. Her parents didn't even – they thought she might be transgender, but didn't really actually start considering it really until she was in kindergarten. And in one of Koi's classes, the teacher had the little boys line up on one side and the little girls line up on the other side of the room. And Koi went to the little girl's side, and when the teacher corrected her and had her go back to the other side with the boys, it really upset her, depressed her. She was not having a very good school experience after that. And that's really when the parents were forced to start, hey, looking at this is our child. We're going to have to start making some changes based on this. So really for me, it was trying to learn as much as I could about Koi and answer the questions that are the pretty obvious questions.
When it comes down to a lot of the confusion, it seems often to me that what we're talking about is language. It's about signals and words, pronouns. I want to ask you this, Heidi, as somebody who studies gender and feminism. What's the goal, or how do we move into a place where we have a more diverse language with which to address these kinds of ambiguities ultimately?
There are a couple things that Julie said. She mentioned compassion at some point. And it may sound fluffy and it may sound, cheesy, but it really, really does take a kind of compassion that Stephanie is talking about as well when she talks about the way that she approached the story and really caring about the way that people see themselves, sometimes more than the way we see them. And that just really takes a kind of compassion that I think a lot of us, and I'm including myself, struggle with. We have various pronouns now that we've introduced to our language to try to describe some of these ambiguities that you're talking about. We have Z instead of she and he. And a lot of times in the classroom and in the streets, I find people getting really frustrated and annoyed with having to care about how people want to be talked about. Why do I have to go through this stress of calling you what you want to be called? Well, we do it on a daily basis. It's just, when do we get annoyed with it? When I walked into the room, Julie introduced herself as Julie and Stephanie introduced herself as Stephanie. And far be it for me to start calling them Tammy and Rebecca. I'm going to call them by the names they want to be called. So we do this on a day-to-day basis. It's just, when it comes to certain issues, we get really annoyed because it disturbs the way we've understood our lives for all of our lives. You know what I mean? We've understood gender as male and female for hundreds of years. So now for us to be forced, you know, we feel assaulted. You're changing the way I think about and see and live in the world. And it's really uncomfortable when people get scared. But I think that's why the theoretical work is as important as the work on the ground. Not more important, not less important, but as important, because we can change policies all day long. We've had affirmative action for how many years? We still struggle with racism and sexism. So we've had the policy for 50 years. But people's minds and hearts are still stuck in the past. So we have to keep talking about it, even when it's uncomfortable, because that's going to be the catalyst for the real change, in conjunction with the policy changes and the legal changes and the on the ground activism.